Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ian Kropp, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This is a 48-year-old woman who presented with a clearly locally advanced cancer. She had palpable about 4 or 5 centimeters, and there was clear bulky adenopathy. So, you know, we treated her with what we typically use in patients with higher risk HER2-positive cancer. Her case was ER-positive as well, with neoadjuvant AC followed by paclitaxel and trastuzumab and pertuzumab.
Could I just ask, was it your sense that she delayed coming in, was aware of this, or do you think this is just a rapidly growing lesion?
You know, that's a good question. In this particular patient, I don't think, I mean, her cancer, she had relatively large breasts, and so on exam, you know, it was clear this was a good-sized cancer, but it wasn't causing any change in the breast shape, and, you know, she wasn't doing breast exams up until, you know, she found this incidentally. You know, this was not breaking through the skin. There was no obvious manifestation of this, and I do think that, I mean, I treat patients in Boston, and so certainly this may not be completely generalizable, but I think the number of patients now who ignore a breast cancer is pretty small. I think it's just, you know, there are cancers with pretty bad biologies that grow, you know, under the radar fairly quickly, and when they present, they're already fairly significantly advanced.
So I also want to ask you about your choice of neoadjuvant therapy. I was mentioning we had just done this survey of 50 general medical oncologists, and we were comparing it to practice patterns in a survey you participated in that had 30 clinical investigators. And one thing I noticed was there was more anthracyclines used by investigators. So can you talk about at what point you start bringing anthracycline into neoadjuvant therapy? And also, what about the out-back approach? Is that still valid?
Yeah, so those are two important questions, and I think there's going to be some shift, or I think there should probably be some shift based on the evolving data. On the anthracycline question, there clearly are two very reasonable either neoadjuvant or adjuvant regimens that can be used in HER2-positive breast cancer these days. One is the anthracycline regimen, which is, for most of us, AC and either paclitaxel and trastuzumab and pertuzumab, or docetaxel and trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And that's been tested in multiple adjuvant studies and also been looked at in neoadjuvant trials as well. And then the other is the non-anthracycline regimen, which is docetaxel, carboplatin, and trastuzumab and pertuzumab. Again, been tested in a large adjuvant trial, been looked at in multiple neoadjuvant trials. And, you know, it's pretty clear that both types of regimens result in very good outcomes in either the adjuvant setting or the neoadjuvant setting. In the neoadjuvant setting, we have studies showing past CR rates of 60%+ with both types of regimens. So I think a case could be made that either approach is very reasonable for the moderate to high-risk patient.
Just out of curiosity, are there direct comparative data to show the exact value of adding an anthracycline? Or is this pretty much indirect comparison?
Well, so, I mean, we have a randomized trial from BCIRG 006, which was comparing AC followed by docetaxel and trastuzumab versus the TCH regimen. There's no pertuzumab in that trial. It was an older trial. And in that trial, which was, I want to make very clear, was not designed to compare those two chemotherapy regimens, both of them showed good benefit compared to the non-trastuzumab regimen. But if you look at the absolute outcomes in those two, the non-anthracycline and the anthracycline arm, you know, in absolute terms, there was a little bit numerically better outcome with the anthracycline. We have a number of other anthracycline-based trials. And so our group does tend to use anthracycline still in the higher risk patients. Obviously, anybody who has increased risk for cardiac toxicity, we use non-anthracycline regimens.
So you're bringing back flashback memories of Dr. Dennis Slaman. This is like, what, 2005, that trial, I think.
Yes, right around there.
But it wasn't like a very big difference, and I don't even think it was statistically significant.
No, and again, as I said, it was not even designed to test that question.
Right.
But that's really the only true randomized data with long-term outcome that I know about comparing anthracyclines versus non-anthracyclines. You know, we have neoadjuvant trials that have compared, so like Trifina, which looked at anthracycline, taxane versus TCH. Both of those had pertuzumab, and again, both of them had very high past CR rates, pretty similar in the mid-60s.
So I'll be curious once we get into the Catherine data whether that's affected whether you're using anthracycline, no, then you kind of got another tool out there. But anyhow, what happened with this lady?
So she had a very good response, still had a little bit of residual disease, but a very good response. We continued the trastuzumab and pertuzumab for a year, you know, to complete a year of HER2 therapy, and she's done very well since then. So even though she started out with quite high-risk disease, she's now, I guess, almost 3 years out and, you know, has done very well.
Any tolerability issues with treatment, either the antibodies or chemo?
Yeah, so I think most of us are familiar with the potential toxicities of the chemotherapy part of the regimen, and she overall did fine with that. Adding pertuzumab does add some toxicity in this particular person. She had non-trivial amounts of diarrhea, especially early on. It was responsive to Imodium. She didn't have to take substantial time off of her teaching job. And like most patients, once she got to the antibody portion, once the chemo was completed, the diarrhea essentially became a non-issue. And all the studies have shown that most of the added diarrhea associated with pertuzumab happens in the period where they're getting concurrent chemotherapy.
Can't believe that I never heard that stated before. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, again, I think that that's not only what's been seen in the trials, but also in our clinical experience.
Makes sense. So I guess, of course, the issue here is what was seen at surgery.
Yeah, so she had a small amount of cancer. She did not have a pathologic complete response. I think she had less than a centimeter of invasive cancer in the breast, and she had one lymph node that still had invasive cancer, but multiple lymph nodes had shown treatment effects. So she clearly did have substantial disease at baseline.
So what did you do about her axilla?
So she ended up having a complete dissection and then got radiation, post-lumpectomy radiation after that.
So if she had had negative nodes, what would you have done? And let's say path CR completely.
Yeah, so, you know, right now there's a question amongst our, you know, the local therapy groups regarding somebody who starts out with known positive lymph nodes and then has a path CR at the time and sterilization of the lymph nodes, what the appropriate therapy is. There is a cooperative group study going on in the United States that's asking that question of whether those patients need radiation or not in a randomized fashion, which I think is really nice that it's being tested in that way. And similarly, there's another trial looking at, for patients who still have residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy in the axilla, what's the appropriate management? Do they need further surgery or is radiation acceptable?
So as you know, a lot of times what we do is when trials are ongoing, we are also asking people what they do. And I remember another survey we did about neoadjuvant therapy, and in terms of the axilla, what we saw investigators, and it was both surgical and medical oncology breast investigators were saying at that point, it was a couple years ago, was in general after neoadjuvant therapy, negative sentinel nodes, no axillary dissection, positive sentinel nodes. In contrast to the adjuvant situation, axillary dissection. Is that kind of your algorithm outside trial?
Yeah, no, I think it is. And again, I think that's why it's really important that we have some data from randomized studies telling us what to do, you know, especially given the effectiveness of these systemic therapies now that arguably, hopefully will change how much local therapy these patients need. And it would be great to have definitive data to confirm that.
When I saw this case, I was thinking 2017, and now we're going to talk about 2019, but also I think we should talk about 2021 and whether or not, you know, we're going to be starting to look at tissue predictors to identify patients like this before they ever even get treatment. But we'll get to that in a second. Let's start out with 2019, which really 2018, December, the Catherine trial. Can you explain the design of that trial, the eligibility, how it was executed, and what they saw?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this was a very visionary study, to be honest. I remember when this study was initiated, many of us weren't sure that it was actually a feasible study. But basically, the design of the study was it looked at patients like this who received, you know, any number of standard neoadjuvant therapy. So it's for patients with HER2-positive cancers, regardless of hormone receptor status, who received some type of neoadjuvant HER2-directed therapy. It just had to be 6 cycles of something. It had to contain a taxane. It had to include trastuzumab. It didn't exclude patients who also received pertuzumab, although that was only about 20% of the patients who actually went on the study. But it was patients who received some neoadjuvant HER2-directed therapy off of trial, but then had residual invasive cancer, and it could be any amount of residual invasive cancer. They were then eligible for this trial. So you have a relatively heterogeneous population, patients who receive some anthracyclines, some patients receive non-anthracyclines. As I mentioned, 20% of patients received pertuzumab and trastuzumab, most just received trastuzumab. And then they went on this trial where they were randomized to what was considered the standard, which was at the time completion of a year, essentially 14 cycles of trastuzumab, or switching to T-DM1, the antibody-drug conjugate against HER2, again, for the same duration of therapy. And when they looked at invasive disease-free survival at 3 years, the difference was quite striking. The hazard ratio was 0.5 in favor of T-DM1. That translated to about an 11% difference in disease-free survival. You know, really stark, unequivocal benefit to switching to this antibody-drug conjugate compared to just continuing the trastuzumab. And that was irrespective of whether they had had neoadjuvant pertuzumab or not, irrespective of hormone receptor status. The subgroup analyses on the forest plots were remarkably consistent in terms of this hazard ratio of 0.5 being across the board.
I'm curious, you said you weren't sure whether or not it would be feasible to do the study. What were the concerns?
Well, just that, you know, at the time, it was not a, you know, this was before the CREATE-X study, which was kind of a similar design in triple-negative patients. It was not a situation where clinical trials were being done after, you know, we had trials in the adjuvant setting, we had trials in the neoadjuvant setting. We didn't have this kind of hybrid approach.
So I guess one question is, you know, you have done work on T-DM1 / pertuzumab, which we can talk about, in the neoadjuvant setting. What would you say if you saw a second opinion, assuming there was a way to get it paid for somebody who had significant residual disease, where the first doc recommended T-DM1 plus pertuzumab as adjuvant therapy?
Yeah, so, you know, we really don't have data on that particular combination in a way that tells us that it's better than T-DM1 alone in that situation. We have now several neoadjuvant trials looking at T-DM1 plus pertuzumab showing good pathologic complete response rates, but not clearly showing that the addition of pertuzumab adds to the efficacy of T-DM1. We have data from the metastatic setting, which seems to suggest that adding pertuzumab to T-DM1 did not result in improved outcomes. That's the Marianne trial in the first-line setting. So you look across at the data we have, the evidence that we have, I really don't see anything that says that this particular patient in whom we have the Catherine data showing good outcomes using T-DM1 alone in the adjuvant setting warrants adding pertuzumab to that. And, you know, it certainly probably adds some toxicity. Obviously, it adds cost. So I think it's really hard to justify doing anything else in the neoadjuvant setting other than T-DM1 alone for a patient like this.
Another thing I'm curious about, at least I don't know if it really makes any difference anymore because of the tolerability, safety of this strategy and the efficacy, but prior to this, there were these systems out there. I think one of them was called RCB, residual disease systems, to try to predict. I'm curious how that sort of played out in the trial, particularly in the control group, and I'm guessing that even in the lowest amount of residual disease, there was still significant absolute benefit.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that was such a given. I mean, I think you could have, you know, intuitively you could make the argument that, you know, patients, we do know, as you suggested, that if you look at how much cancer someone has after neoadjuvant therapy, which can be quantified in a very standardized way using this residual cancer burden algorithm from MD Anderson and Fraser Simmons, you know, that the amount of residual disease is quite prognostic. And so you could imagine that if you looked at patients with very small amounts of residual cancer, that the benefits of something like T-DM1 would be minuscule. But in the data from Catherine, that doesn't seem to be the case, that the relative benefit of T-DM1 over trastuzumab was very similar regardless of how much cancer was left. And even if you look specifically at the patients who only had less than a centimeter of cancer and no negative disease at time of surgery, the hazard ratio was still quite good. I think it was 0.6, and that translated to an absolute benefit of 5%. So it really does seem like, at least the data we have at this point, that basically any amount of residual invasive cancer, I'm not talking about residual DCIS, but residual invasive cancer, I think you should think strongly about using T-DM1 in that situation.
I'm really glad because I never really understood that RCB system and sounds like it's maybe not going to be as relevant anymore. or at least it was kind of hard to figure out for me anyhow.
Well, it's hard. I mean, the mathematical equation is actually very complicated. Fortunately, they've put a website that does the calculation for you. You just plug in the pathologic data. So, I mean, I think there is still a lot of interest in using RCB, and in other cancer situations, it can be very helpful. But I think for HER2 positive post-neoadjuvant, you're right. The Catherine data kind of says that, you know, it's more of a dichotomous situation. You either have invasive cancer residually or you don't. And if you do, then it doesn't really matter how much.
That's interesting. I never thought about it, but do they break that down based on ER-HER2 subtype, like triple negative versus HER2, or is it just one number?
So the RCB is independent of receptor status. But just to be clear, you know, having an RCB of, you know, 2.1 is associated with different prognosis, whether you are ER negative, ER positive, or triple negative.
Yeah, you would certainly expect that. Getting back to the question I was bringing up before about choice of neoadjuvant therapy and this kind of case of this woman that you just presented, now that you've got this sort of in your back pocket of 50% knockdown after therapy, are you going to change the way you approach using anthracyclines?
Well, so I think that's an excellent question. And the ability to leverage this use of T-DM1, does that allow us now to de-escalate therapy? So having T-DM1 out back and knowing that patients who get trastuzumab and pertuzumab-based chemotherapy neoadjuvantly, you know, now having good past CR rates, can we use those tools to cut back on treatment in those patients who have very HER2-sensitive cancers? So we don't have specific data on that. Actually, we now do, actually, after ASCO, indirectly at least. But there is now a clinical trial that's going to be getting underway within the U.S. Cooperative Group system called the COMPASS trial. It's going to be led by ECOG. That's basically taking patients with stage 2 and 3 HER2-positive cancers and treating them neoadjuvantly with 4 cycles of paclitaxel plus trastuzumab and pertuzumab, a very well-tolerated regimen. So no platinum, no anthracycline. And if they have a pathologic complete response, then they will not get further chemotherapy. They'll just get the dual antibodies to complete a year and will be done. And that's asking this question of, if you have a pathologic complete response with lesser chemotherapy, does that still translate to very good outcomes? And we have, you know, a number of studies that would suggest that's the case. The most recently, we have Christine, which was another T-DM1-based trial. This one was comparing TCHP versus T-DM1P, which did show increased past CR rates with the conventional chemotherapy arm compared to T-DM1. But what we learned recently, presented by Sarah Hurvitz at ASCO, was that in the long run, the patients who were on the T-DM1P arm did just as well as those who got TCHP with one caveat, and that is you had to take out those patients who progressed during their neoadjuvant therapy, which was about 6 or 7% of the patients on T-DM1 pertuzumab and 0 on TCHP. So clearly there were some patients who did not respond very well at all to TCHP, and those patients, you know, don't do well in the long run unless they get additional therapy. But if you take those patients out and you took the patients, whether they got a PCR or didn't get a PCR, overall the outcomes were the same, whether you got TCHP up front or T-DM1P up front. That would support this idea that if you have a pathologic complete response, it doesn't really matter how you got there, that you're going to do well.
The next thing I had written down here was this issue of paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab. Because I've been starting to hear about cases, mainly a lot of them coming out of your institution from various people, where people were doing that. It kind of made complete sense. It kind of goes back to the adjuvant APT trial that you all did. It kind of sounds like this is the neoadjuvant version of that.
Well, it is. I mean, it's with pertuzumab, right, which is slightly different than the APT,
paclitaxel,
which is just, right. I mean, I think the general idea here is we know that there is this group of HER2-positive cancers that are just exquisitely sensitive to HER2-directed therapy. And they need a little bit of chemotherapy, but they probably don't need that much. And we're getting these past CR rates, you know, in the, you know, 40-plus percent range from just getting 4 cycles of paclitaxel and trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And again, the data from Christine would support this idea that it doesn't really matter how you get to your past CR. If you get it, you're likely to do well. And adding on extra chemotherapy isn't really needed, isn't going to make a big difference.
You know, there are very few sort of quality of life or patient perspective outcomes that are reported comparing paclitaxel versus, say, carbo-docetaxel as partners for anti-HER therapy. Maybe you're aware of some that are convincing, but when you talk to patients and you talk to docs, it sounds like a substantial difference. How much data do we have to show there's a difference? And in your own clinical experience, how much of a difference is there?
So I can't, off the top of my head, think of a randomized trial that compares just a taxane pertuzumab or taxane trastuzumab regimen to a combination chemotherapy trastuzumab regimen. But I think if you've used these regimens in a reasonable number of patients, it's pretty clear that adding an anthracycline or adding carboplatinum to docetaxel, or even just using docetaxel compared to paclitaxel, it's a very different experience for many patients. Paclitaxel is remarkably well tolerated when you're just giving 12 weeks of it at 80 milligrams per meter squared. And now with the usage of cold caps, you can alleviate the alopecia in a large number of those patients. So it's a remarkably well tolerated regimen. Some patients get into some issues with neuropathy, but that's usually something that's very manageable with dose reductions if it happens. So it's really the gestalt. Again, without randomized data, the gestalt is that this is a much better tolerated regimen than either TCH or ACTH.
I am curious about the cold strategy, how it plays out at Dana-Farber. How do you do it? How often do people elect to do it? And how effective is it?
So, I mean, you know, the randomized data would show that it's quite effective for non-anthracycline regimens. That's been our experience. It's not effective in everybody, but, you know, in the majority of patients, they really have very little, if any, noticeable alopecia when they're using it. It does add to the cost to the patient in most cases. You know, there are some ways to try to help with the cost, but it's still a non-trivial financial burden for patients. And so that's oftentimes a decider for patients whether they want to do it or not. But we offer it to all patients who are getting non-anthracycline regimens.
What about the experience itself? How uncomfortable is it?
You know, I mean, with the mechanized versions that don't require the patients to bring in tubs of dry ice and things, some patients notice some mild discomfort. But other than that, it's not really a big issue. It does add the time that they're in the clinic because you have to pre-cool and keep the cold caps on afterwards, after the infusions as well, for a period of time. But I think most patients feel that the trade-off is very worthwhile. Those patients who really are concerned about the risk of alopecia.
Before we get into where we're heading, a little bit more about Catherine. Could you talk a little bit about what was seen in terms of tolerability and toxicity with T-DM1 and what some of the issues are using T-DM1 now in the adjuvant setting?
Well, you know, we've had experience now with T-DM1 in the adjuvant setting now through a number of trials, only one of which has been reported up until Catherine, which was a pilot study that we did a long time ago showing that it was feasible to give a year of T-DM1 in the early disease setting. But it's quite tolerable. I mean, I think those people who've used T-DM1 in the metastatic setting are pretty familiar with the toxicity profile. There was no unexpected toxicity seen in Catherine or in our pilot trial. About 18% of patients stopped the T-DM1 prior to completing the full 14 cycles. And the reasons for discontinuation were kind of the expected things you see with T-DM1, many of which were laboratory abnormalities that didn't substantially affect the patient's quality of life. So, I mean, for most people, it's pretty tolerable. There is more toxicity than just a year of trastuzumab, but I think for most people, it's quite manageable and not a big impact on quality of life.
What specifically do you expect or you counsel a patient in terms of risk related to thrombocytopenia and LFT abnormalities?
Well, I mean, we know from the studies that it does happen and it requires dose modifications in some percentage of patients, but the clinically meaningful consequence is quite low. Bleeding events have been very low, and I'm not sure they specifically called that out in Catherine, but the main reason for discontinuation were, as you alluded to, were thrombocytopenia, transaminase elevations. But in most cases, those are not clinically impactful. They're just something that we see, and we modify the dose to try to prevent a clinical complication.
So T-DM1, I think, really was the first major, you know, commonly used antibody-drug conjugate that was utilized, I think. But subsequently, now we have bevacizumab out there and a bunch of other antibody-drug. And T-DM1 is kind of always thought about as being the poster child of how non-toxic it is. But I have heard people claim, and of course, it's very, very hard to figure this out, that there are quality life issues. I don't know, like chemo kinds of feeling bad, fatigue type. Do you think, I mean, obviously it'd be hard to figure that out. Do you think that happens?
I mean, I think there are some patients who do have real clinically meaningful toxicity from T-DM1. And you're right, they're the kinds of toxicities that are a little hard to tease out. But there are patients who definitely have nausea with each cycle. There are patients who have fatigue. You know, headache is seen. And whether the kind of cognitive effects, you know, the chemo brain kinds of things. I mean, I've had patients tell me that they've noticed that things feel a little different, but that's hard to tease out. I have never seen a neuropsych type of analysis of patients on T-DM1, which I think you'd have to do to really try to tease that out, like has been done with chemotherapy. But there are patients who do notice something on T-DM1. But I think if you look in the totality of experience with T-DM1 compared to, you know, any chemotherapy, T-DM1 tends to be better tolerated. And that's what's been seen in all the randomized trials. Compared to trastuzumab alone, which has, you know, very little toxicity, T-DM1 does have more. But for most patients, it's a very manageable thing. And doing a year of it or 14 cycles of it is manageable for most patients.
Not to mention that the benefit really is spectacular. So what a trade-off. So obviously, neratinib is out there in the sort of post-adjuvant space, so to speak. And with all these changes going on, I'm kind of curious how it's effective at all, the way you approach that decision. In the adjuvant setting, what we've heard from investigators is they think about it for higher-risk patients, node positive, ER positive. A lot of people will think about it or maybe present it. I don't know exactly what people think about it. I'm curious what you think in terms of post-neoadjuvant. I have heard people say for higher-risk patients that even though maybe we don't have the data exactly that they would do it. Right now, what's your approach to using neratinib?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we're all struggling with how to incorporate all of these new data, particularly Catherine, into our treatment paradigm. And using neratinib after pertuzumab was already an extrapolation because in the Extenet trial, which was the post-adjuvant neratinib trial, patients hadn't received prior pertuzumab because of when the Extenet study was performed. So that was already an extrapolation. I think many people were comfortable with it in high-risk patients, just as you described, the high-risk ER-positive, node-positive patients, given that, you know, we really were trying to maximize benefit given their risk level. And now we have T-DM1, which is going to be used, you know, I would think, almost universally in such a high-risk patient who has residual cancer after neoadjuvant treatment. Then that would require a further extrapolation since we have no data on the effects of neratinib after T-DM1 or pertuzumab, and these patients will have had both. So I think we're, again, moving into this kind of data-free zone, which was what we don't like to be, particularly in the adjuvant setting where we can't even tell whether our drugs are working for a given individual. But I do think that when you're confronted with a very high-risk patient, someone who has multiple nodes positive after residual cancer, and you know, if you look at that subset in Catherine, those patients still had a substantial risk of recurrence despite T-DM1. That in such a patient who's ER positive, I think it's still worth considering neratinib, but it's without definitive data that it's effective because of their prior therapy, and it's a relatively small population. But I don't think neratinib is completely out of the question for these high-risk patients, and I would still offer it to such a patient. But it's a pretty niche population at this point.
But you know, that ER thing is really interesting. And I guess if you think about it, they're also on hormonal therapy at the same time, really. So you think you're given neratinib, but you're actually given neratinib plus hormonal therapy. What about in the metastatic setting? Has that strategy been used?
Well, so no, I think you raise a good point. And that's been the hypothesized mechanism of action of neratinib in that setting is it helps block the crosstalk between ER and HER2. And that's why it's synergistic with hormonal therapy, particularly in ER positives, where we didn't see any benefit in the ER negatives in Extenet. And in the metastatic setting, we don't have any data yet, as far as I know, of combining neratinib, if that's what you're asking, combining neratinib plus hormonal therapy. We actually have recently started an investigator-initiated trial looking at the combination of neratinib with or without fulvestrant to hopefully definitively ask that question to see whether we can replicate what's happening in the adjuvant setting, in the metastatic setting, where it's a little easier to follow. So we'll see whether we can see that kind of synergy. Interestingly, in the NALA trial, which was the metastatic neratinib trial that just got reported, virtually all the benefit was in the ER-negative HER2-positive cancers as opposed to the ER-positive. So exact opposite of what was seen in Extenet. Now, just to be clear, that was done in the absence of hormonal therapy, so perhaps that is why we see this big difference. And maybe that does say that you need a hormonal therapy around when you're using neratinib, but it's a little complicated with chemotherapy also in the mix. So I think this trial that I just mentioned, combining fulvestrant and neratinib, is a little bit of a cleaner way to ask that question.
So I want to start to move more towards where we're heading in the future, particularly in terms of new agents, but also I want to probe a little bit in terms of predictors of response to treatment. This is something that there's been a lot of interest in breast cancer and all cancers for that matter for a long time. And you've done some really interesting research. A lot of it was reported at ASCO, both in the neoadjuvant as well in the adjuvant setting, actually looking at the affinity data, which I thought was really amazing. So can you talk a little bit about sort of the body of this work and kind of what you think it means?
I think this is one area that, despite making a lot of progress in developing new anti-HER2 therapies, which have, you know, led to improvements in outcomes in both early and late stage disease, you know, where we've come up short is coming up with true prognostic and predictive biomarkers that tell us who benefits from these therapies, whether a particular person is going to benefit more from an antibody versus a tyrosine kinase inhibitor versus a conjugate. You know, we haven't done a good job there. And I think we're starting to learn perhaps why that might be the case. And we did present data from the AFFINITY trial, which, as many of you may remember, was this large adjuvant phase 3 trial that was looking whether adding pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting to chemotherapy and trastuzumab led to improved outcomes. This was a positive trial, but the absolute benefit was pretty small. Hazard ratio is only around 0.8, statistically significant, and in higher risk patients, it definitely was clinically significant, but the magnitude of the benefit was less than we would have hoped. And so the goal of this biomarker analysis was to try to identify patients who may particularly benefit from pertuzumab and differentiate those patients from those who might not benefit at all from pertuzumab and therefore the pertuzumab could be avoided. So this was a pretty big undertaking. You know, AFFINITY was 4,800 patients. And we tried to be as comprehensive as possible. We looked at not only kind of standard things such as HER2 levels and amplification and hormone receptor status, but used an RNA-seq analysis to look at how the transcriptional profiles changed or how transcriptional profiles were predictive of HER2, of the addition of pertuzumab. And we looked at mutations with a DNA analysis. So a pretty comprehensive analysis. We also looked at immune biomarkers. And what we found was that despite this fairly exhaustive analysis, the things that really mattered were immune markers. And, you know, I think in some ways that was surprising given that this is a HER2-directed therapy and, you know, we're very interested in HER2 signaling effects. We didn't really see a whole lot there. What we saw was these immune effects. And it didn't matter whether we looked at gene signatures of immune activation or just the very simple presence of immune cells using these tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte analysis, which is a very simple thing that you can do just on an H&E sample. Either way, those cancers that seem to have evidence of immune activation at baseline, either because they had a large number of TILs or because they had a strong immune gene signature, those are the ones who not only did better overall, regardless of which treatment arm they got, but those were also the ones who seemed to benefit from the addition of pertuzumab. And that's now been seen, you know, I think it was pretty conclusive, or, you know, we thought it was fairly conclusive in this study. We saw some similar data from the metastatic setting with Cleopatra, where high levels of TIL seem to predict benefit of pertuzumab. And it's been seen in other settings with trastuzumab as well, although the data there have been a little mixed. So if you put that together, I think what it says is that trastuzumab and now pertuzumab are working at least in part by helping activate the immune system, and it's not just its effect on blocking HER2 signaling, which again, I think is something that was a little surprising maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but now when you start looking at the totality of the data, it's all pointing in that same direction. And now we have these data, pardon me if I switch gears quickly, but we have this data on margetuximab in the metastatic setting presented at ASCO, which was a drug that works solely by potentiating the antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, this ADCC effect, the immune effect of trastuzumab. That's its main mechanism of action compared to standard trastuzumab. And you see, again, a benefit there, even in pretty late-stage patients. So I think what we're seeing, if you put everything together, is that these HER2-directed antibodies are working, at least in part, through immune-mediated mechanisms. And I think that that's kind of an interesting take-home message that we're seeing.
Or could you state that the better the immune system, the better the activity, that it requires an intact immune system, or it works better with an intact immune system?
Yeah, no, I think that that's another way of looking at it. And I think if you just looked at affinity, that would be a very reasonable conclusion that you need to have an active immune system. And if you already have evidence of that, then these antibodies can then potentiate that. But then if you look at the margetuximab data, which says that these really are working via an immune mechanism. It's not just that the cancers are already being recognized by the host immune system, and that's just a biomarker of that. You know, the benefit of margetuximab would suggest that there really is a clinically meaningful component to this immune effect.
Is there a thought, or do you have the thought, of trying to combine immune stimulation, I mean, checkpoint inhibitors, for example, in this setting?
So, yes, I mean, I think certainly that's been an idea. There are good preclinical data suggesting synergy between trastuzumab and between T-DM1 and immune checkpoint inhibitors. But so far, the data there have been a little mixed. Shireen Loy did a single-arm phase 2 study of trastuzumab plus the PD-1 inhibitor pembrolizumab, which showed a pretty small benefit, only about 15% of response rate, and that was only in the PD-L1 subset. And then there was a study called KATE2, which looked at T-DM1 plus or minus a checkpoint inhibitor. Again, a negative study overall. Looked like there might be some activity in the PD-L1 positive, HER2 positive cancers, but again, not a dramatic difference. So just adding a checkpoint inhibitor to HER2 therapy doesn't look like it's going to be a real game changer. So perhaps we need to do other approaches. There are now some studies going on looking at other immune-targeted drugs that may be synergistic with trastuzumab, one of which is a drug targeting immune marker called 4-1BB or CD137, which is important for this ADC effect on natural killer cells and T cells. So that looks promising, and there are several trials going on looking at that antibody. But it doesn't look like just adding a checkpoint inhibitor in the study so far has been substantially beneficial.
What about the issue of trying to predict whether neoadjuvant therapy is going to be helpful? I know you've looked at HER2 heterogeneity. I mean, would there be a way to identify a patient like this up front and say, well, we need to do a different strategy?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's a good question. And so, you know, we did a study recently, which very simple trial, just treated 160 patients with 6 cycles of T-DM1 and pertuzumab, no conventional chemotherapy, and showed a pathological complete response rate of a little bit more than 50%, consistent with some other studies and consistent with Christine. But the main goal of that trial was to look at whether levels of heterogeneity, and what we mean by heterogeneity is, you know, whether there were differences in the amount of HER2 expressed from one cell to another within the cancer, which we know exists, but we really haven't paid attention to that much before. But our, you know, the hypothesis was that if we use a purely HER2-directed regimen, that if you have some cancer cells within the tumor that are not expressing HER2, that you're not going to be able to kill those with the HER2 therapy, and therefore you're going to lead to less complete responses in those tumors that were heterogeneous versus those that had homogeneous expression of HER2. So a pretty simple idea. The trial showed exactly what was hypothesized, which was that the pathologic complete response in those cancers that were homogeneous for HER2, which was the vast majority of cancers, the response path CR rate was 55%, and the path CR rate in the patients who were heterogeneous was 0. So about as, you know, kind of black and white as you can imagine. And, you know, it goes along with this idea that if you have substantial heterogeneity in your cancer for HER2, that using just a HER2 therapy alone is probably not going to be enough.
Although it looked like it was only, what, 10% of the patients?
Right. So in this trial, the true heterogeneous patients were only 10%. But in those 10% of patients, you know, again, we saw no pathologic complete response. A lot of patients had substantial residual disease. So we're now going back and looking at whether that was a very stringent definition of heterogeneity. If we use a more mild, you know, more comprehensive, less stringent definition, do we still see big differences in path CR rates? We're now going back to analyze that. You know, a simple thing we look at is whether a cancer is HER2 3+ versus 2+. We saw similar kinds of differential activity if you were 2+ versus 3+. And actually, that was seen with Christine as well, that those cancers that were 2+ had a much lower rate of path CR than those who were 3+. So I think it's, again, it's not that unexpected that if you have less uniform HER2 expression, that drugs that specifically target HER2 aren't going to work quite as well.
That's interesting. I saw that there, but was it also sort of corrected for the degree of amplification? In other words, if you have two tumors that are amplified, you know, whatever, but one has IHC 2 or 3, is there a difference?
So, I mean, in our particular study, we didn't have enough numbers to say that it didn't make a difference, but the effects of heterogeneity were independent of 2+ versus 3+. So even within the 3+ patients, the heterogeneity still mattered. But, you know, you have all these different measures of HER2 expression, whether they're all independent or whether they're all pointing in the same direction. I think it's, right now, we don't know the answer to that.
What about changes in HER2 status over time? Where are we today with that? Do you ever biopsy people because they're suspicious one way or the other? They've either gone from positive to negative or the reverse. How often does it occur? Is it really a therapeutically meaningful thing to look at?
So, I mean, I think that's been looked at in both, and I'm just to be clear, you know, there's two situations where you might be thinking of that. One is in the neoadjuvant setting, when they get neoadjuvant HER2 therapy, how many of the residual cancers become HER2 negative? And that's been looked at, and there are some, you know, it looks like it's less than 20%, but it's not single digits. And then there's the metastatic setting, which is a cancer that starts out HER2 negative and becomes HER2 positive and vice versa. There's not, in the metastatic setting at least, it doesn't seem like there's a large number of patients who start out HER2 positive and then become HER2 negative in the metastatic setting. It's certainly less than 10%. You see a little bit more going the opposite direction, starting out HER2 negative and becoming HER2 positive. So at least in that situation, in the metastatic, it doesn't seem like it happens that much. I think one interesting question is, in the metastatic setting, when you've treated with multiple lines of HER2 therapy, and you know now we have a number of different HER2 treatments, and so patients often go through 5, 6, 7, 8 lines of HER2 therapy in the metastatic setting, do you start losing HER2 expression over time? And we really don't know the answer to that, but it's certainly something that needs to be looked into, because you can imagine that after hitting the cancer with HER2 therapy with, you know, regimen after regimen, that one escape mechanism could be that they start losing HER2. But right now, we don't have data in those late patients to be able to answer that.
So let's move on now and talk about new agents in the HER2 space. And also, I want to get into the issue of management of brain mets. And I asked you to pull a case from your practice of a patient who had brain mets, and you brought up this 63-year-old woman diagnosed in 2010 with de novo metastatic disease, gets a bunch of different therapies. And I just want to focus on the point at which it looks like at one point she was getting T-DM1 for metastatic disease and then had progression in the brain, but was continued on T-DM1 at that point. Let's start there. What was going on with the woman at that point?
So that's an interesting question. So you have many of you who treat these patients will be familiar with this situation where someone is on a systemic therapy. In this particular patient's case, it was T-DM1. She'd already had brain mets in the past, but they were treated with whole brain. While on T-DM1, she developed progression of, I think it was a couple of those lesions that had previously been treated, but they were amenable to stereotactic radiosurgery because she hadn't received that before. And so the rest of her disease was completely stable based on your extracranial disease, based on CT scans. So we treated her with SRS. We continued the T-DM1.
Before you go on, could I just pick up on that point? Because that has been a very major issue that has been emphasized. I think ASCO brought it up with their consensus statement. This issue of the patient who's stable or not progressing, but then progresses in the brain, the concept you just talked about, you keep the systemic therapy going. In this situation, what do you think is going on? Actually, I have a question that someone sent in who had heard interviews with Dr. Hope Rugo and Joyce O'Shaughnessy talking about the fact that T-DM1, quote, crosses the blood-brain barrier. And this person says, the only data I see with this large molecule conjugate crossing blood-brain barrier is the metastatic setting, where, quote, maybe the blood-brain barrier is already breached with radiation therapy. Is there any data of T-DM1 crossing the blood-brain barrier in the, let's say, adjuvant setting? This person wants to know.
Right. So that's a very good question. And so Hope is correct that we do have data in the metastatic setting suggesting that trastuzumab crosses the blood-brain barrier when there's a tumor present, a parenchymal HER2 brain metastasis present. And we have case series and a cohort trial showing that in some patients, treating with single-agent T-DM1 is able to shrink brain metastases. But in the adjuvant setting, we really don't have any data saying that, as you suggested, that if there's not a tumor there and therefore presumably the blood-brain barrier is intact, that a large macromolecule like T-DM1 can get into the brain. The one negative piece of data we have, which is very recent from Catherine, is that the one situation where T-DM1 did not seem to be superior to trastuzumab was in preventing CNS recurrence as a first site of progression. Hmm. And there was absolutely no benefit. In fact, I think the T-DM1 arm was actually a little worse. So fortunately, that doesn't happen very often. It's about 4 or 5% of patients. But in that situation, it did not look like T-DM1 in the adjuvant setting did anything to prevent those brain metastases. And that would speak to this concern that with a intact blood-brain barrier, that T-DM1 is not efficacious in the brain.
So it looks like that's about the point that you took over. You got involved with their care in 2017. She's got progression in the brain and in the liver. So what happened at that point?
Right. Well, just to go back, though, you know, she did do fine on continuation of the T-DM1 for some period of time. And we've all seen that. Studies have shown that the median after CNS progression is in the 4 to 6 cycle range. So it's not a trivial amount of time that patients can still be benefiting from systemic therapy if you treat locally the brain. And that's why those ASCO CNS guidelines are what they are, which is that if the extracranial disease is controlled, there's not a strong reason to change your systemic therapy at that point.
So it's kind of an escape lesion. How long did she stay on just the T-DM1?
For her, I think it wasn't a year, but it was at least 3 or 4 months, which I think is pretty typical. Some patients do well even longer than that, which is why, again, it's worth trying that. But eventually her liver disease progressed on the T-DM1, but at that time her brain metastases also were progressing and she was not felt to be a good SRS candidate at that point. So fortunately at our institution, we have a number of clinical trials for patients who have progressive brain metastases. It's a big research interest of our group. So she went on a trial of trastuzumab plus tucatinib. And tucatinib is a new HER2-directed tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And what's unique about tucatinib, which has gone by previous names, it used to be ONT-380, and before that it was Array-380. But what's unique about this molecule is that unlike lapatinib and neratinib and afatinib, most of the other HER2 kinase inhibitors, which hit not only HER2, but also EGFR and HER4, tucatinib is very specific for HER2, the HER2 tyrosine kinase. So because it avoids inhibiting EGFR, you don't get a lot of the diarrhea and rash that come along with EGFR inhibition. And tucatinib gets into the brain quite well because, again, it's a small molecule. So that was the rationale for using tucatinib with trastuzumab in this trial. And she went on that study and did quite well for, I think, 7 or 8 months.
Could you talk a little bit more about tucatinib in terms of what's been seen in terms of response and tolerability?
Yeah, so, I mean, as it was billed because of its preclinical data being very HER2 specific, rates of diarrhea are very low, rates of rash are very low, and it's got some mild fatigue. But other than that, it's really been quite well tolerated. And that's what led to its registrational trial, which is called HER2 Climb, which is an add-on strategy. So that trial is looking at patients who've had progressive HER2 positive metastatic disease, randomizing them to capecitabine trastuzumab with or without tucatinib, or in fact, it's placebo-controlled for tucatinib. And because it's so well-tolerated, an add-on strategy was feasible, and that trial is completed its enrollment, and we're just waiting for the data to mature. What's nice about that trial is it's leveraged the ability of tucatinib to get into the brain, and therefore, unlike, as far as I can remember, any other large randomized trial, it allowed patients who had progressive brain metastases on that study, and hopefully we can look at that subset and really ask for the first time in a randomized fashion whether a drug is able to meaningfully control progressive brain metastases.
So what happened with this lady?
So she did very well in the tucatinib and trastuzumab. She tolerated extremely well. She, just as a coincidence, she's also a teacher and continued to work. Eventually, her brain metastases started to progress, and so we happen to have another trial going on of capecitabine and neratinib, again, another tyrosine kinase inhibitor that gets into the brain quite well. The difference between tucatinib and neratinib, other than the fact that neratinib also hits other HER family members like EGFR, is that neratinib is an irreversible inhibitor of HER2 and, you know, perhaps maybe a little bit more potent. So she was on the study of capecitabine and neratinib, and that combination also, she's done very well on that and continues to be on that regimen with good disease control now out more than a year. Again, this is with chemotherapy. The previous trial was without chemotherapy, but she's done quite well. And again, I think this speaks to this fact that, you know, there are some HER2-positive cancers that are just very sensitive to HER2 inhibitors of multiple types, and these people can do well for many years just sequencing the different inhibitors.
How did she do on the neratinib capecitabine, and how do people do in general? When I first heard about it, you start to think a little bit about the potential for maybe problems, at least thinking back to lapatinib. But in any event, how did she do?
So, I mean, she, like most of the patients on that regimen, you know, had some diarrhea. We use Imodium as primary prophylaxis, just as now is being done clinically. And she still had some breakthrough diarrhea. And I think in her, we added Lamotil at some point. But eventually, things settled down, as usually happens with neratinib, is that if you can get patients through the first, you know, few cycles, the diarrhea becomes much more manageable. And again, she's been on it for over a year and actually right now has virtually no diarrhea. And she's only taking the Imodium intermittently and is doing quite well. There are certain foods that seem to stimulate her diarrhea, but otherwise she's doing quite well. And this combination of capecitabine and neratinib, and I should point out that the capecitabine is not full dose in this trial. It's 750 milligrams per meter squared twice daily, which is actually the same combination that's used in the NALA trial that also was reported at ASCO. And in that trial, again, used primary prophylaxis, still had a substantial amount of diarrhea, but the number of patients who had to discontinue was, you know, only a few percent because of diarrhea. So again, it is certainly a substantial problem. You have to educate patients very aggressively. You have to use antidiarrheals from the get-go, but most patients, you can get through it.
So I'm kind of curious, hopefully this response will continue for a long time, but what are you thinking in terms of next steps if she does have progression? Both, are there trials you might think about or non-trial strategies?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the underlying problem here is there are no approved regimens for patients with CNS disease with HER2-positive cancers. The NCCN has indicated that that neratinib capecitabine regimen is a reasonable thing to try, but there's no, you know, specific FDA approvals for a regimen in the brain. You know, this patient, you know, will have already gone through several different tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which is something that we all think about using in this situation because we know they get into the brain well. She's already had capecitabine. So after this, you're kind of in a data-free zone in terms of what you can do. You know, we hope to have a clinical trial for her. Right now, we have trials looking at immune therapy in patients with brain metastases, looking at CDK4/6 inhibitors like abemaciclib, which has some data suggesting some activity in the brain. So that could be another option for her. But, you know, outside of a clinical trial, there really isn't much that has substantial data to support its use. I mean, there are chemotherapies besides capecitabine that can get into the brain that have shown some case series kind of responses, but it's definitely an area that needs some work.
That's interesting. I didn't pick up on the fact that she was ER positive, but I see she had letrozole at one point. I mean, that works in the brain. Has she had a CDK inhibitor even though she's HER2 positive?
Well, so that's what I was saying, is I think that, you know, we do have a trial of abemaciclib, and I think that would be something that would be very worth exploring.
But she hasn't had one outside a trial?
No, we generally haven't been doing it because there is no label and no, you know, large data series of CDK4/6 inhibitors in HER2-positive disease. But there are preclinical data suggesting that they could be quite effective, and there are small studies now showing efficacy in HER2-positive disease. So hopefully, eventually, there'll be enough data to tell us one way or the other whether we should start using these CDK inhibitors in HER2-positive disease on a more regular basis.
Although, you know, we never talk much about hormone therapy in HER2-positive situations, but I mean, has she had fulvestrant?
So she hasn't, and that would be something else to think about. You know, again, we have some data on early stage HER2-positive metastatic disease that hormonal therapy plus trastuzumab and pertuzumab can be effective. There's similar data with trastuzumab and lapatinib and hormonal therapy that have shown pretty good activity. So it is something that I think we forget about because of, you know, all of the HER2-directed therapies in the later line of treatment. But there are patients who seem to benefit quite substantially from hormonal therapy plus HER2-directed therapy. And there are now randomized data to support that. But most of those data are for early metastatic patients. Whether that still is effective in later lines, we don't know. It's something that's worth evaluating.
I mean, if you're running out of options.
I completely agree. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and that would certainly be something that we would explore for a patient like this. And again, there's a little bit of a preference for abemaciclib because of its ability to cross the blood-brain barrier, which hasn't really been established so much for the other two CDK4/6 inhibitors.
So let's finish out, again, along the lines of new therapies and hear about your 31-year-old lady.
Yeah, so that brings up an interesting new drug. So I have a 31-year-old woman who had HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, had progressed on multiple lines of therapy. She lives in upstate New York, and so traveled here, traveled to Boston looking for a clinical trial. And we happen to have a phase 1 study of a new antibody drug conjugate, this one called trastuzumab deruxtecan, also known as DS8201A, neither of which are very euphonious titles, but hopefully it'll get a better name eventually. But this is an antibody drug conjugate that's like T-DM1. It's based on trastuzumab, or based on the HER2-targeting antibody. But what's different between this conjugate and T-DM1 is that the payload is a topo-1 isomerase inhibitor, which T-DM1 is a microtubule inhibitor, so this is a topoisomerase inhibitor. So different class of chemotherapy. It's a very potent payload. And unlike T-DM1, which has 3 or 4 payloads per antibody, for this conjugate, there's more like 7 or 8. So eventually twice as much chemo per antibody, a very potent chemotherapy.
So just in my naive ears, I hear topo, I think of anthracyclines. Is that right?
So this is more like topotecan or renotecan.
Oh, topotecan. Yeah. Okay. Got it.
This is a topo-1 inhibitor.
Topo-1. Okay, great.
Yeah. You know, and this is a class of chemotherapy that we don't generally use in breast cancer, so none of the cancers have typically seen this kind of class of chemotherapy. And there's a lot of them on each antibody, so the amount of drug that's delivered is quite high. And this one is structured to have what's called bystander effect, meaning that the payload is able to leak outside the cell that's being targeted and hit neighboring cells, which, you know, may help with this idea of heterogeneity that we talked about earlier. So the basic same idea as T-DM1, but perhaps more potent because there's more chemotherapy attached and it's a very potent chemotherapy in a different class. So the data we have so far for this, which is from that phase 1 trial that this patient of mine was treated on, is that this is a very active drug. So in the phase 1 trial, which was recently published in Lancet Oncology, the response rate in heavily pretreated patients, patients all of whom had had prior T-DM1, most of whom had had prior pertuzumab, the response rate was approaching 60%. Objective response rate was 60%. Progression-free survival was over 20 months, which is really quite astounding in this population. And this patient, my patient, has had a good response as well, and she's been on it now for quite a few months and doing quite well.
It says here she started end of 2017, so I mean like a year and a half.
Yeah. And so again, the median progression-free survival in this trial has been over 20 months.
Wow.
So it's really kind of unprecedented. If you think of like the Amelia trial, which was in a pretreated population with T-DM1, again, not that we should be comparing cross-trial, but you know, the median PFS with T-DM1 was only 6 or 7 months. So this really looks like an active drug. Now, the trade-off is that it has more toxicity. You know, and whether that's because it's a more potent chemotherapy or because of this bystander effect, it's not clear, but it definitely has more toxicity. So there is about a third of the patients have hair loss. Nausea is definitely more prevalent with this than with T-DM1. This patient, perhaps partly because she's so young and there's a more predisposed to nausea, you know, had a substantial amount of nausea when she first started. We've been able to control it by increasing her antiemetic regimen with each dose. And now that she's been on it for a while, the nausea is really largely gone. So it's definitely manageable, but it's definitely something to pay attention to, and it's different than T-DM1. So we've seen alopecia, we've seen GI toxicity. And then the one other thing that's been noticeable with this drug is that there is more pneumonitis. About overall, roughly 10% of patients have been getting some degree of pneumonitis, and there have been some fatal cases.
Hmm.
So hopefully now that we've gotten more familiar with this potential toxicity and we're able to manage it better, we will, you know, get rid of the more high-grade toxicities of pneumonitis, but it's definitely something that we need to pay attention to when using this drug.
What happened to this woman's hair?
So she actually has kept her hair. She started out with a lot. I can't remember whether she's had any thinning, but looking at her hair has been fine. Instead, it's only about a third of patients who've lost their hair or have had some degree of substantial degree of alopecia. So
what do you see in terms of counts, cytopenias?
So there have been some cytopenias. So in addition to the thrombocytopenia that seems to be somewhat of a class effect, the thrombocytopenia is no worse than T-DM1, but there has been some more neutropenia and anemia seen, although it hasn't really been dose limiting for this drug. It's the other things that we've been more paying attention to.
What about activity in the CNS?
So we don't really have much data on that. You know, so like most early trials of novel therapies, we've been excluding patients who have progressive brain metastases. So we don't really know. Again, this is a big molecule, so I wouldn't expect it to be much different than T-DM1, but we don't really have data to speak to that.
I'm not sure if I've seen data on this, but has it been looked at with HER2-negative disease?
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting finding, was that in the original trial, in this phase one trial, there was a cohort of patients with HER2-low disease. And what we mean by HER2-low are non-amplified, but either 1-plus or 2-plus HER2 expression by IHC. And somewhat surprisingly, there was quite a bit of activity in that population as well, with a response rate of over 40%. And that's been now the motivation for a large randomized trial in HER2-low patients comparing this drug versus treatment of physicians, you know, chemotherapy of physician's choice in pretreated, largely ER-positive HER2-low patients. If that's borne out in that registrational trial, it really is a true game changer because, you know, right now we don't think of those patients as anything other than HER2-negative because from a practical standpoint, whether you're 0 or 1-plus or 2-plus doesn't matter. We don't treat them with HER2-directed therapy. If this trial, this phase 3 trial, shows benefit of trastuzumab deruxtecan in that HER2-low population, it really creates a whole new breast cancer subtype. And there's another HER2 conjugate that's also seen some activity in HER2-low patients as well. So it may not be unique to this drug.
So I'm curious how many patients have been treated who previously progressed on T-DM1. Actually, this woman progressed on T-DM1. And it looks like she didn't have much of a response either.
No, she didn't. And she did respond earlier to other HER2 therapies, but she had virtually no response to T-DM1. And that phase one trial I told you about with the 60% response rate, that was all patients who had had prior T-DM1.
Wow.
And 60% had also had prior pertuzumab, and that didn't seem to affect the response rate at all. That also was 60%. So this drug does seem to have activity regardless of prior therapy. It's really impressive in that way.
So where was this woman's disease when she got treated and what exactly happened?
So this particular patient had mostly lung disease, which is a little unusual for HER2-positive cancers, which typically goes to the liver as well. Her disease was mostly in the lung, and her burden of disease wasn't that great, but she was having some pulmonary symptoms, and you know, now her lesions have shrunk and her pulmonary symptoms have largely gone away. Her cough is gone. She's got no dyspnea. And in fact, she's a runner and she's been running. It's funny, sometimes she complains about fatigue, and she says, you know, she's only been able to run 5 miles, you know, 5 miles 3 or 4 times a week, which, you know, makes me look like a weakling. But no, so she's, you know, now that the nausea has been controlled, her quality of life is pretty good, and she's really not limited by her cancer or by the drug, which, of course, is what we want to see.
So you don't have to hear about too many cases like this to be thinking about using it, because now you're talking about just using a treatment by itself. You're not adding something on. It's just this drug. And you don't have to hear too many cases like this to maybe be thinking about for your patient. Is there a compassionate use protocol right now?
As far as I know, there's not a compassionate use study, but the company has announced that they're accelerating their BLA submission to the FDA. And so I think they're hoping there's a phase 2 trial that's completed enrollment that they're going to use for submission for accelerated approval. And they're hoping to get that submitted before the end of the year. So I think the hope is that this drug will become available, you know, in the relatively near future and will not have to wait for the several phase 3 trials that are going on right now.
Yeah, I always think about the ibrutinib versus chlorambucil trial. Do we really need to do that in CLL? And like, you know, how many cases do you need to hear like this? But I guess that's just the issues in terms of the regulatory system. Anything else going on in terms of HER2 disease that you want to comment on that you think is important?
Well, I mean, I think what we've seen and what we continue to see is that if you come up with a new HER2-directed therapy that works via a different mechanism, it's still quite a valid target. And, you know, even though, as we talked about a little bit earlier in this conversation, there is this concern that tumors can lose HER2 expression over time, then, you know, you see the data with drugs like this new conjugate where you're seeing 60% response rates in heavily pretreated patients, and that would seem to suggest that HER2 still remains something that we can go after even after multiple lines of therapy. You know, in terms of the next set of drugs, this isn't the only antibody conjugate that looks promising. There are others in development as well. We talked a little bit about immune therapies, and while there we don't have yet much activity that's been demonstrated, you know, it's still something that we're very hopeful about. And we just need to figure out new ways to do it. There are other tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are being evaluated. And I think there's still plenty to be hopeful about in the future in the pipeline. So I think this is an area where, fortunately, there's been a lot of progress made. We're now starting to talk about dose de-escalation, as you mentioned earlier. Can we start cutting back because patients in the early disease setting are doing so well? So again, I think it's a pretty hopeful time in the HER2 space.